Hello, and welcome back to Boundaries Plus. I am so happy to be back with you. Last month's episode, I shared a portion of chapter 2 from the book White Rage that I am reading with my Patreon subscribers, and today I'm doing the same. Today it is the back half of chapter 4, Rolling Back Civil Rights, and I'm sharing this because there are parallels with how propaganda shows up in the news, and as we know, there's a lot of that happening now in the ways that we are able to identify it and recognize it and move away from it. There is also the discussion of how the stereotypes about Black people created biases against Black people and how those were born from the Reagan administration and the terrible, terrible things that he did, and including starting a drug crisis so that he could then declare a drug war. So I'm going to be moving on to reading the book now, or uploading the portion of the book. And if you have any interest in this, if this is what you enjoy, please consider subscribing to my Patreon. There we are going through the book chapter by chapter, and we're not reading, we read a chapter over a couple of weeks, and I offer journal prompts. And in that space, it's a way to have a little bit deeper conversations, things that you identify, questions that arise from what's being read from me. So consider being a Patreon subscriber. And I hope that you enjoy this episode. And I hope that you enjoy this section of the reading. Y'all make sure to stay hydrated. Hello, and welcome back to the reading of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. If you've been reading along with us and you know that we're about halfway through chapter 4, we're going to finish that chapter today, which is Rolling Back Civil Rights. If you are just joining us, we have been reading this book. You can catch up on my YouTube channel if this is where you're watching it. If you are a Patreon subscriber and you're new, then you can catch up here. There is collections available in both places. This book has been really, it's been a really deep and heavy read, but it's been indicative of how the racism in this country is a continuation of things, that history is a continuation and it's not repeating itself. Thank you for being here, and let's get started. If you are reading along, we are on page 129, the first full paragraph, about two-thirds of the page down. While there was inordinate concern about avoiding prison sentences and the legal consequences for those who poured tons of cocaine into the United States, there was an equal determination to lock up and imprison the communities bearing the brunt of the White House's narco-funding scheme. Unlike in 1981, when Reagan had indicated that treatment for addicts was the route he would take, his speeches and policies now became focused on enforcement, criminals, and harsh no-mercy punishment. With the onset of the epidemic of crack, a drug that had become thoroughly associated with African Americans, and again, crack became associated with African Americans because when cocaine came into Los Angeles, especially East LA, cocaine is an expensive drug. People found out you could cook it down. Crack, it became more accessible to Black communities. Notions of treatment went out the window. Despite numerous studies proving that treatment was not only more effective, but also more fiscally sound and prudent. And as one DEA agent remarked, no one has yet demonstrated that enforcement will ever win the war on drugs. Nonetheless, Reagan dragged America down with the road down the road of mass incarceration. So Ronald Reagan funded this drug scheme to bring cocaine into the states. Ronald Reagan created this war on drugs so that he created the war on drugs as a result of the drug crisis that he created. Then he took a drug that could be cooked down to then become more accessible to African Americans, to Black Americans, making them seem like they are using it as a higher rate. And then as a result, imprisoning and jailing these Black people instead of offering rehab, which is what he promised or what he spoke to ahead of time, Ronald Reagan created a drug crisis to then fill up prisons. Each of the Reagan administration's decisions undercut the supposed stated goals of protecting American families, preventing the flow of drugs from washing onto the nation's shores, or bringing democracy to a war-torn society. The decision to fund the Contras with profits from the sale of cocaine, for example, came at a time when the economic downturn had created high unemployment, increasing homelessness, the depletion of savings, and other major stressors, which only heightened the possibility of creating a drug-addicted society at the very moment when narcotics use had actually stabilized or decreased. As the horrific toll crack cocaine caused in the inner city became more and more obvious, the administration's response was not to fund a series of treatment facilities, but to demonize and criminalize Blacks and provide the federal resources to make incarceration rather than education normative. Drugs are menacing our society, the president told the nation in a September 1986 speech delivered from the White House. They're threatening our values and undercutting our institutions. They're killing our children. The United States, he conveyed, was a nation under attack. Again, these drugs were able to make it into the States because of Ronald Reagan, the president of the United States at the time, who then made this speech saying that drugs are threatening the values and undercutting institutions and killing our children. This is just the insidiousness of that. We talk about anti-Blackness a lot and how it shows up and how it's evergreen and how it's present. But this is a level of insidiousness. This is a level of hatred towards Black people to do all of this, to put so many other people at risk, because let's not think that it's only Black people that were using drugs. Putting so many people at risk as a way to get back or to continue to oppress, imprison, and demonize Black people. That is so much hatred for people for just existing. Despite our best efforts, Reagan added with a hint of shock and dismay, illegal cocaine is coming into our country at alarming levels. At that point, in what looked like the nadir of surrender, Reagan identified public enemy number one, crack. And then, just to reaffirm the heroes and villains in this set piece, the president sent out a clarion call proclaiming, quote, drug abuse is a repudiation of everything America is, end quote. He positively vibrated with a sense of righteous patriotic indignation. No one, he intoned, has the right to destroy the dreams and shatter the lives of the freest society mankind has ever known. In this important speech, the president not only laid out an epic tale of good, freedom-loving Americans locked in a mortal battle for the nation's soul against crack addicts and drug dealers, but in doing so, he also defined the racial contours of this war. Media fanned the flames and then some. With little to no evidence, news outlets warned that crack, reputably the most addictive drug known to mankind, was galloping out of the crime-filled inner cities and, as Newsweek claimed, rapidly spreading into the suburbs. The New York Times echoed the refrain identifying, quote, epidemic crack use from Long Island to the, quote, the wealthiest suburbs of Westchester County. The media's overwhelming tendency to black and crack only added to this national panic. Between 1986 and 1987, 76% of the articles in the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times dealing with crack referenced African Americans either directly or through code words. Urban, inner city, etc. Whites were mentioned only one third of the time. The message was clear. The Black plague was coming. Let's stop there for a minute. We know what's happening in Palestine right now, right? And we talk about history being a continuation of itself. This is going to speak to this portion right here. The media is talking about propaganda. One thing that we are recognizing with what's happening in Palestine right now is that with the way that we have access to news, the way that we have access to social media, the way that we are getting information in real time, accurate information, it has thrown the people that operate through propaganda into a tizzy. Because there are actual facts that we can see that we can dispute and refute the things that are being said to try and amplify the situation and make the people that are being oppressed, the oppressors, to make the ones that are being harmed, the violent ones, to make the victims, the victimizers. We get to see that it's not true. In this time in the 80s here, that was not available. So all of these news sources were able to just run with whatever was being told to them, to report it, to print it, and people believed it. Instead of actually paying attention to what happens, because there was no access. This is how so much was able to happen. This is how media was able to get away with so many things. This is how so many people believed so many violent things about Black Americans, because the media took what they believed, with no evidence at all and demonize Black people up and down their articles based off of a drug crisis that was created by the President of the United States. When we tell you to be curious and to ask questions, this is why. Because if you don't and you take things at face value, you can be missing the entirety of a situation and jumping to a conclusion that just is not true, and in that being complicit in the oppression that's happening. The crack plague had already swept through African-American neighborhoods around the country with absolutely no warning. I want to stop for a minute. I want to make sure that it's acknowledged that the drug crisis became a big crisis and an epidemic when it reached wealthy white neighborhoods. That's when it became a problem, because it affected white people. The crack plague had already swept through African-American neighborhoods around the country with absolutely no warning. There had been minor use of crack in the 1970s, but it began to visibly show up in 1984 and exploded in 1985 and 1986, just as Congress cut off funding to the Contras, leaving the administration desperate to finance the war against the Sandinistas. As battles over lucrative drug turf escalated, Black communities were besieged with rampant gang violence. Most had no idea how this crack scourge had arisen, or how those who had once toted simple handguns now carried AK-47s and other automatic military-grade weapons. It was clear immediately that something had gone horribly wrong. A National Urban League report declared that the gains made over the past 25 years, many the result of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, will unravel unless steps are taken to arrest the pervasive problem of crime in the Black community. A research team from Harvard and the University of Chicago explained, quote, between 1984 and 1994, the homicide rate for Black males aged 14 to 17 more than doubled, and homicide rates for Black males aged 18 to 24 increased almost as much. The magnitude of the firepower and the sheer number of killings were, in fact, critical factors that led African-American life expectancy rates to actually decline, something that not even slavery or Jim Crow had been able to accomplish. Moreover, many other sectors of the Black community were also horrified by the murders and crack, fetal death rates, low birth weight babies, and children now in foster care. The researchers concluded that the perilous decline of African Americans on so many quality of life indicators, quote, represents a break from decades of convergence between Blacks and whites on many of these measures. The divergence, however, was about to get exponentially worse. In 1986, Congress passed the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, which stipulated mandatory sentencing, emphasized punishment over treatment, and created the 100-to-1 disparity in sentencing between crack and cocaine based on the myth that the cheap narcotic rock was more addictive than its powder form. As the NAACP explained the law's 100-to-1 formulation, a person must, quote, a person must possess 500 grams of powder cocaine before they are subject to the same mandatory prison sentence 5 years as an individual who's convicted of possessing just 5 grams of crack cocaine, despite the fact that pharmacologically these two drugs are identical. A person must possess 500 grams of powder cocaine. Cocaine is an expensive drug. That is not a secret to anybody. So somebody has to have 500 grams of cocaine to have the same sentence as somebody that has 5 grams of crack cocaine, the same drug that's just delivered differently. The National Urban League was convinced that tougher sentencing policies were not the answer. The incarceration rate would be so high, it warned, that society would not be able to bear the cost. Congress, nonetheless, followed up in 1988 with an even harsher version of the Anti-Drug Abuse Act that instituted mandatory sentencing for even a first-time offense, added the death penalty for certain crimes where drugs were an aggravating factor, and denied housing and other human rights to those whose greatest crime was having a friend or a family member in the drug trade even visit. The Supreme Court had played a critical role in tightening the noose. A series of cases beginning in 1968, but escalating dramatically in the Berger and Rehnquist eras, legalized racial discrimination in the criminal justice court. The court, this is going to be a list, affirmed that police, even though their overall racial bias is well documented, can stop anyone based on something far below the under the understood threshold of probable cause, stop and frisk, approved racial profiling, upheld harsh mandatory sentencing for drug offenses, tossed out irrefutable evidence of racial bias in sentencing because of its implications for the entire criminal justice system, and required, instead of proof of overt visible discrimination against the individual defendant to support a claim of violation of equal protection under the law, approved, as the justices openly admitted, ridiculous peremptory strikes to eliminate blacks from a jury so long as a prosecutor's stated rationale was not based on race, meaning you could have a black person that was supposed to be on a jury duty and somebody could say any other thing as long as they didn't mention race. Shielded district attorneys from disclosing the role that the defendant's race played in prosecutorial discretion. Ruled that police could use their discretion instead of probable cause to search motorists for drugs. Determined that Title VI of the Civil Rights Act cannot be used by private individuals to sue entities such as prosecutors or police in the criminal justice system based on grounds of racial bias. And to round it out, found that pretext traffic stops, for example, having a busted taillight or not using a turn signal, are a legal and permissible ruse for police to hunt for drugs. Taken together, those rulings allowed, indeed encouraged, the criminal justice system to run racially amok. And that's exactly what happened on July 23rd, 1989, in Tulia, Texas. In the dead of night, local police launched a massive raid and busted a major cocaine trafficking ring. At least that's how it was billed by the local media, which, after having been tipped off, lined up to get the best, most humiliating photographs of 46 of the town's 5,000 residents, handcuffed, in pajamas, underwear, and uncombed bed hair, being paraded into the jail for booking. The local newspaper, the Tulia Sentinel, ran the headline, "Tulia Streets Cleared of Garbage." The editorial praised law enforcement for ridding Tulia of, quote, drug dealing scumbags. The raid was the result of an 18-month investigation by a man who would be named by Texas's attorney general as, quote, outstanding lawman of the year. Attached to the federally funded Panhandle Regional Narcotics Task Force based in Amarillo, about 50 miles away from Tulia, Tom Cole didn't lead a team of investigators. Instead, he single-handedly identified each member of this massive cocaine operation and made more than 100 undercover drug purchases. He was hailed as a hero, and his testimony immediately led to 38 of the 46 being convicted, with the other cases just waiting to get into the clogged court system. Joe Moore, a pig farmer, was sentenced to 99 years. 99 years for selling $200 worth of cocaine to the undercover narcotics agent. 99 years in prison for selling $200 worth of cocaine. Kizzy White received 25 years while her husband, William Cash Love, landed 434 years for possessing an ounce of cocaine. An ounce of cocaine. The case began to unravel, however, when Kizzy's sister, Tanya, went to trial. Coleman swore that she had sold him drugs. Tanya, however, had video proof that she was at a bank in Oklahoma City, 300 miles away, cashing a check at the very moment he claimed to have bought cocaine from her. Then another defendant, Billy Don Wafer, had timesheets and his boss's eyewitness testimony that Wafer was at work and not outselling drugs to Coleman. And when the outstanding lawman of the year swore under oath that he had purchased cocaine from Yul Bryant, a tall, bushy-haired man, only to have Bryant, bald and 5 feet six, appear in court, it finally became very clear that something was awry. Coleman, in fact, had no proof whatsoever that any of the alleged drug deals had taken place. There were no audio tapes, no photographs, no witnesses, no other police officers present, no fingerprints but his on the bags of drugs, no records. Over the span of an 18-month investigation, he never wore a wire. He claimed to have written each drug transaction on his leg, but to have washed away the evidence accidentally when he showered. Additional investigation led to no corroborating proof of his allegations, and when the police arrested those 46 people and vigorously searched their homes and possessions, no drugs were found, nor were weapons, money, paraphernalia, or any other indications at all that the housewife, pig farmer, or anyone else related arrested were actually drug kingpins. What was discovered, however, was judicial misconduct running rampant in the war on drugs in Tulia, Texas, with a clear racial bias. Coleman perjured himself on the stand when he claimed to be an upstanding law-abiding citizen. In fact, he was under indictment for theft in his previous position as a deputy sheriff in another county. The prosecutor, Terry McKitchen, knew about this, but failed to disclose it to the defense attorneys. The district attorney also ensured that there were no African Americans on the jury in each trial. Moreover, Judge Edward Self, who presided over the lion's share of the trials, publicly expressed his support for the prosecutors and sealed Coleman's employment records, including the charge of embezzlement as a deputy sheriff. The judicial malfeasance immediately took on racial undertones. Coleman, a white man who routinely referred to African Americans as niggers, had accused 10% of Tulia's black population of dealing in cocaine. Based on his word alone, 50% of all the black men in the town were indicted, convicted, and sentenced to prison. Of the six whites and Latinos who were arrested in the raid, all had relations, familial or friendly, with Tulia's black community. Although the white community consistently denied that race played any role in this, the speed and efficiency in which the criminal justice system worked to sentence black defendants and their white and Latino friends to decades in prison based solely on the substantiated testimony of a man under indictment suggests otherwise. Randy Credico of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice called Tulia, quote, a mass lynching, taking down 50% of the male black adult population like that. It's outrageous. It's like being accused of raping someone in Indiana in the 1930s. You didn't do it, but it doesn't matter because a bunch of Klansmen on the jury are going to string you up anyway, end quote. But this wasn't 1930. It was the beginning of the 21st century, and a powerful civil rights movement had bridged those two eras. Yet now, felony convictions, chiefly via the war on drugs, replace the explicit use of race as the mechanism to deny Black Americans their rights as citizens. Disenfranchisement, permanent bans on jury service, and legal discrimination in employment, housing, and education, despite the civil rights legislation of the 1960s, are now all burdens carried by those who have been incarcerated. That burden has been disproportionately shouldered by the Black community, which, although only 13% of the nation's population, makes up about 45% of those incarcerated. That burden has been disproportionately shouldered by the Black community, which only 13%, the Black community is 13% of the nation's population, but they make up 45% of the people incarcerated. That's terrible math. Even more disconcertingly, these felony convictions have had little to do with ensuring the safety and security of the nation, and in most cases target the wrong culprits. Logically, given the poor state of the schools, crushing poverty, and the lack of viable living wage options for large swaths of the Black population, African Americans' drug use should mirror their staggering incarceration rates. According to Human Rights Watch, quote, the proportion of Blacks in prison populations exceeds the proportion among state residents in every single state, end quote. In Missouri, for example, African Americans make up 11.2% of the state's residents, but 41.2% of those incarcerated. In fact, quote, in 27 states, the percentage of Blacks incarcerated is at least five times greater than their share of the resident population, end quote. But there's no direct correlation between drug use and incarceration. No direct correlation between drug use and incarceration. Despite all the economic and social pressures they confront, Blacks have shown an amazing resilience in the face of drugs. Indeed, they are among the least likely drug users of all racial and ethnic groups in the United States. And despite all the stereotypes, they are among the least likely to sell drugs too. As a major study out of the University of Washington revealed, even when confronted with irrefutable evidence of whites' engagement with the illegal drug trade, law enforcement has continued to focus its efforts on the Black population. Thus, after the Civil Rights Movement, when African Americans were making incredible strides in education, voting, and employment, those gains were a threat to the status quo of inequality. Thus, the, quote, United States did not face a crime problem that was racialized. It faced a race problem that was criminalized. That's the end of chapter 4. As you can tell, or as you might have picked up as I'm reading this chapter has really kind of set me off a little bit. Black people have been talking about the fact that the oppression that we are under has been created by other people to continue to keep us oppressed while doing everything that they can to make us the ones at fault, the ones that have created these issues, the ones they say, clean up your neighborhoods, get rid of the drugs, get rid of the guns, stop the black on black crime. When there is irrefutable evidence that the drug problem was created by the administration, that the neighborhoods are bad because of redlining and lack of access and lack of cleaning and lack of sanitation, that the black on black crime thing is not true, because if you talk about percentages, but especially the over-policing and the over-incarceration or the excessive incarceration of black Americans, to just taking the state of Missouri, like we said, 11.2% of the population is black Americans, but 41% of the people incarcerated are black. You have a man that perjured himself as a way to try to take down an entire black family that went through all of these efforts to lie, to make black people the villains. We see it still today. You see it in schools. You see it in schools where black children are kept from the access and the resources that they needed. And because they don't have the access and the resources that they needed, then they are identified as a problem student or a bad child. And they are put into a special school. They're given detention. They're expended. They are pushed aside. To create these situations, to create these environments where black people are meant to just essentially fail and die, but then to see us still thrive, to see black people still thrive amidst all of that, to try to deny that there is an anger about the way that black people thrive in response to the many attempts to take us down, you cannot deny that that there's anger that comes from that. You cannot deny that the ongoing mistreatment of black people is due to the fact that we just have not given up. Again, some journal prompts. We talked earlier on in the chapter about the propaganda and how the media had been able to lie to all of the citizens based off of not having the facts needed, but also knowing they could print anything and there was no way to verify anything. There was no way to have immediate access to look something up. So people believed what they read. Think about how we are seeing that right now. And right now, between Palestine, the Congo, Sudan, Tigra, all of these current genocides that are happening, we are now getting caught up because we now have access. And that's what makes access, and that's what makes intelligence, and that's what makes curiosity so dangerous to the people that want to continue the status quo of oppression and white supremacy being upheld. Think about how that is carried on. And for this next part, it's going to be a journal prompt, but I really want you to think about this. I really want you to think about, again, how you have been complicit in the way that white supremacy has been upheld. And I want you to take a breath. I want you to take a breath. Before you say, I have not been complicit, I want you to take a breath and think about, again, the stereotypes that you have heard, the bias that you have towards certain areas and neighborhoods and people and situations, the fact that you might have agreed that somebody didn't deserve something because they had been in prison. But we don't know why they were in prison. You just know they were in prison and that they were black and that they probably didn't deserve anything. Think about the ways that you were complicit in the way that white supremacy was upheld. Even if it was just around you, you were still complicit in it because there was not that curiosity to question it. And then I want you to think about, what questions are you going to ask yourself? What questions are you going to ask yourself? What questions are you going to ask society? What questions are you going to look for as part of your decolonizing? What are you going to sit and think about? I've been lied to with reading this book or having it read to you and recognizing what actually happened, even just taking out the Reagan administration and seeing how that man created the crisis that now has black people dealing with so much discrimination. If you think about that, what questions are you going to ask as part of your decolonizing? What questions are you going to ask so that you can unlearn what you've been taught? This is, I've said that I enjoyed reading this book, and I do. It's a heavy book. It's a heavy book, and as you can imagine, being a Black woman reading this, it's a little bit extra heavy reading about what has happened to Black people historically and how that has transferred over to present day. I'm happy to read it. I'm happy that you are here with me. I'm happy that you've decided to listen to some truth. I'm glad that you've made the decision to decolonize your mind. I'm glad that you've made the decision to recognize that perhaps what you have been told to has been less than truthful. I'm proud of you. And we will pick up next week with chapter 5. Take care of yourselves.